I'm Chuck Smeaton from the Royal Institution of Australia, and this is the Cosmos Briefing Podcast. I'd like to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land wherever you are listening from today, and I'd like to pay my respects to elders past, present, and emerging. Where you live affects your health. Every day we walk through cities without considering how they're designed and how they assist or delay our ability to live well. As the climate warms, cities are heating up too. And without interventions, this could make them more deadly. But we can now collect data on this at unprecedented levels, which can help us to change our cities for the better. To help us address these issues, we're joined by Jason Byrne, Professor of Human Geography and Planning at the University of Tasmania, and a researcher of urban political ecologies, of green space, climate change adaptation, and environmental justice. And Professor Billy Giles-Corti, Director of the Healthy Livable Cities Lab at RMIT University. She has also researched the impact of the built environment on health and well-being for over two decades. Today's interview is hosted by Cosmos journalist Lauren Fuge.
Hi, thank you both so much for joining me today.
It's great to be here.
Lovely to join you, Lauren.
Billy, I wonder if you could start by explaining how where you live affects your health, and in particular, how does the built environment have an effect on our health and well-being?
Well, this has been an area of research that's really gone on now for quite a few years, a couple of decades, and we've got stronger evidence all the time, better evidence, that how walkable the neighbourhood is, affects whether or not people walk. Seems pretty basic, but it's true. Whether people have access to green space encourages to be more physically active, not just any green space, but larger green space. Whether people have access to tree canopy, and there's quite a bit of evidence coming out now that tree canopy makes a huge difference. I mean, obviously, the obvious one is the heat island effect in terms of cooling the city, but it also there's evidence now coming out showing that it affects cardiovascular disease, other chronic diseases, including dementia. So the evidence is mounting that the way we build our cities affects people's health, both in terms of chronic disease, but also respiratory disease. Like, for example, where we have neighbourhoods where there's lots of traffic, it increases the amount of pollution, and that affects people's respiratory outcomes and actually cardiovascular disease as well. So it's as the field continues, we're getting more and more evidence to show that healthy cities affects people. I mean, the way we design our cities really affects people's health.
Mm-hmm. Lauren, one of the really interesting bodies of research, but also an activist movement that began in the United States in the late 1970s, it's called the Environmental Justice Movement. People of colour and low-income earners who are predominantly exposed to unhealthy, insalubrious neighbourhoods, like Billy mentioned, exposure to traffic, but also things like particulate pollution from diesel, a whole range of toxic release emissions from factories and other chemical processing plants and waste treatment plants bear a disproportionate burden of environmental harm. And so we know that that health in cities is distributed along the lines of class, of race, of ethnicity, education levels, jobs, these kinds of things. And so it's really interesting when we look at the kinds of measures that Billy talked about with walkability, lower income earners and more disadvantaged people have worse access to high quality walking environments, for example. The surfaces of pavements are not well maintained. There's something called a food desert where we will see lots of fast food restaurants and supermarkets that don't sell very many fresh fruit and vegetables concentrated in these communities that are predominantly lower income communities. And that even extends to gun stores and alcohol outlets as well. So it's quite amazing when we start to drill into health about how where we live does affect our health and well-being in very profound ways.
And Jason, I wonder, what are the concerns around climate change and how it will affect health in cities? Are different Australian cities, for example, affected more severely at the moment by climate change, and how will that change?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we know that climate change is going to impact our cities in widely different ways. Some cities will be exposed to rising sea levels more dramatically than other cities. We've seen that already with coastal erosion on the New South Wales coastline. Gold Coast is heavily exposed to coastal flooding and increased cyclonic activity and to sea level rise. But heat is what many people would call the silent killer. So since the 1890s, we know that heat waves have killed, and extreme heat events have killed more Australians than any other natural disaster combined, which is a pretty amazing statistic. Climate change will multiply heat in cities. There's something that planners and health researchers called the urban heat island effect. And cities tend to be between 8 to 15 degrees warmer than surrounding countryside and parklands. And so when you add climate change as a magnifier on that, as a climate stressor, we're going to see places like Western Sydney that are already experiencing temperatures around about 50 degrees in the middle of summer experience extreme heat events that are even higher than that. We're seeing places in the Middle East recording temperatures of close to 60 degrees at the moment from some of those unverified weather temperature recordings over the last few years. So as a silent killer, cities need to do something about heat and to act very quickly to minimise those heat impacts that are driven by climate change.
Mm-hmm. I just want to add another couple of things, and that is that climate change is going to affect ecosystems, which will change exposure to infectious disease, you know, the waterborne diseases and vectors, so mosquitoes and things like that. So we'll expect to see more, as we see the habitats changing, we will expect to see more of these infectious diseases, and we'll also expect that we're going to see more mental health problems, because we can see the pressures that this is causing. The fires that we've just experienced in last summer, which were just traumatic for everyone, apart from the feeling distress at seeing that, the smoke that came over our cities. I live in Fitzroy. I could look out to the city and see the air was blanketed in smoke, and the levels of pollution that we had from the smoke were at hazardous levels, according to the World Health Organization. So we will see more respiratory diseases, as well as we're not going to protect cities from fires, apart from the people who live in the regional areas that are really directly affected by the fire. But even in cities, we're going to be affected by that. So I think climate change is going to have massive impacts on us. And when we start to upset ecosystems, that underpins life on Earth. So we don't really know what's going to happen to us as a result of that.
Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right, Billy. When I looked out my window here in my office in Hobart, in the big fires in Tasmania that preceded the ones that occurred up the East Coast, you couldn't see very far outside the window. We had some of the worst levels of air quality on the planet at that time. And as Billy said, we've seen that in the East Coast cities up and down the eastern seaboard of Australia as well. So some big issues.
Jason, what measures can we take to manage the effects of urban heat?
Some of the things we can do to manage urban heat range from changing or retrofitting existing buildings and roads. So part of the urban heat island effect changes depending on vegetation levels, and I'll come back to this one in a second. A road that's not covered by trees will be about 20 to 25 degrees Celsius warmer than one that has really good tree canopy coverage. In fact, that can be road temperatures that are 30 degrees or more hotter. The same with roofs. Dark coloured roofs, and we see a lot of them in Australia with the supposed Scandi fashion to have dark tiled roofs, absorb a lot more heat than lighter coloured roofs, which reflect and heat away from them. So they can be, again, 20 to 30 degrees warmer. So some of the initiatives that are being trialled around cities like New York and Los Angeles and Baltimore include painting roads with a reflective coating to reflect heat away from them. And the same with painting roofs. In fact, there's a city in India that the United Nations Environment Program lists on its website as having made some fantastic inroads into treating urban heat. And this is Ahmedabad in India. And according to their calculations, painting the roofs of informal settlements lighter coloured paint saves about 1,000 lives a year. Wow. So that's, yeah, so it's a big number. But these are expensive interventions, and we know that paint contains all sorts of cocktails, and that potentially paint can run off into waterways, and we might find that we compound microplastic problems. So if we're going to get back to that point that Billy raised about potential ecosystem collapse and about non-human species being affected by climate change, and think about an intervention we can put in place that is comparatively less expensive and politically more palatable, it's urban greening. So we know that if we plant large numbers of trees across our cities, and we can already see this from research on parklands and green spaces, that those areas are about 8 degrees cooler than areas without good tree canopy cover. But I'm sure, Billy, you have some of this really interesting data as well, right, about the beneficial effects of urban greening, including on mental health and physical health, because places that are greener are also more walkable, and people get some big mental restoration benefits from places that are greener too.
Billy, what are other ways that we can make our cities healthier aside from reducing heat effects?
Well, I mean, I guess when I was thinking about the, just from a climate change perspective, the other advantage of, you know, solar passive orientation, you know, how we design our buildings for a start. I always find it amusing when I see architects putting black around the windows. And I think, well, why would you do that? You know, facing the sun, putting black around the windows. I think we need to think more carefully about our orientation to the sun, just to cool the buildings down. And from a mitigation perspective from climate change, it's so critical that we do these things, because it'll actually reduce the amount of energy people are using in terms of heating and cooling. So it's really important that we start to think more seriously about that. But I often think about in my research is around how we foster more sustainable mobility. So walking, cycling, public transport use. And this is really critical. Transport emissions are significant, and 24% of global transport emissions are greenhouse gas emissions are from transport related sources. So thinking about how we can transition to cities that really take seriously walking, cycling and public transport use is really critical. Cycling is a no-brainer, particularly in flat cities, and even with cities that are hilly. What we're finding now is, in terms of a health benefit, electric bikes are second to mechanical bikes in terms of the benefit to health, you know. So, but people do use quite a lot of energy when they're cycling, even on an electric bike. So transitioning to really taking cycling seriously, as we've seen in Europe. And when you're talking about big cities, that means that we need to be thinking about not just the inner city. We always think about the inner city as providing cycling infrastructure in the inner city, but where we've got public transport hubs, we could be putting cycle paths within 5 kilometres of all the train stations or the public major bus routes, so that people have a choice whether they drive to get public transport or whether they use an alternative, and cycling is a really good one. It's efficient. Walking is great and it's very beneficial to health, but the trouble is you can't walk very far. And so I think we do need to transition. C40 is talking about this at the moment in terms of building back better. The 15-minute city is what it's calling it. In Melbourne, we call it the 20-minute neighbourhood. In Sydney, they call it the 30-minute city, but that's mainly focused about getting people to employment. But the idea of the 20-minute neighbourhood or the 15-minute city is that people have lots of amenity nearby. And that means that what we need to be doing, it's building our cities in quite a different way. We need to be moving away from just thinking about accessibility to proximity, creating cities of short distances, so that we create cities of villages rather than just the way we're doing it at the moment, which just tends to be like a big CBD and not really focused on trying to get all that amenity into the local communities. So I think there's a lot of work to be done. It's an exciting agenda, and it's terrific to see that C40 are picking this up. And this is all the C40 is the mayors of all the megacities, and they're looking at this very seriously as a post-COVID activity to build back better, more sustainably, more climate change friendly, and also more equitable. So I think there's a lot of work to be done in that regard.
Mm-hmm. And as we do this work to make cities more livable, I imagine it's going to be quite important to collect data to monitor the health of urban populations as well. How are we going to do that? How do we collect that data?
Well, I think there's a couple of ways that we can do that. We can be, for a start, I think seeing how the built environment's changing, we can use geospatial data to be able to collect that. That's relatively straightforward and it should be done. We should be having indicators, not just of the downstream, what's the air quality like, but the upstream, what's changed to change air quality, for example. So do we have better public transport? Do we have, how much traffic is on the roads, that sort of thing. So we could be doing things in quite a different way. And I think having the geospatial indicators that measure upstream determinants of health and wellbeing are really important. It is difficult, actually, to measure health behaviour, because if we want to create indicators so that different local government authorities, for example, can see what's happening in their city, in their own area, then we have to sample that at the local government area level so they've got enough data so that we can create an indicator. So that's expensive, but it's important. There are other sources of data, of course, we're increasingly, from our phones. It's amazing what you can get from a phone these days. And I think we need to start to get creative about using some of those indicators. But I think what's really important is if we need to get to a point where we can actually geolocate them, not necessarily the specifics of where someone lives, but an area so that we can actually collate that to see what's happening in those areas. And we can start to benchmark and monitor cities according to how much activity is going on the ground in parks or in local areas. So I think there's lots of opportunities. Air quality is another one, clearly very important. But I think as we mobilise and harness to use data or big data ethically, I emphasise ethically, I think there's great opportunities there, which I think it augurs well for the future of being able to monitor cities in a much more sophisticated way than what we've been able to do in the past.
Mm-hmm.
Lauren, if I might add, there's remote sensing data that we can use as well, and we can pair that with population health data in really interesting ways. So we already have some nationwide surveys in Australia, like the HILDA data set it's called, and there's a sample of people around Australia that fill out these surveys, and it helps us understand disease prevalence in the community. But we can then also pair that with transport behaviours, how many people are driving a car versus taking public transport. We know that Australian cities are highly car dependent compared to cities in Europe and especially cities in Asia. And that high level of car dependence has some quite pernicious consequences. So for example, people who are commuting for a long time, sitting on their bottoms in their cars for an hour and a half a day or 3 hours a day sometimes for some populations, are much more exposed to coronary heart disease, diabetes, and several types of cancer as well. They tend to be more overweight and obese because people are not getting good levels of daily exercise. And also comorbidities associated with mental health, poor mental health, depression, anxiety, and potentially suicidality down the track. So our cities are increasingly not just obesogenic, causing obesity, but depressogenic as well, linked to depression and anxiety. So we can start to do some really interesting things with that data, though. We can take remote sensing satellite data. We can use that data to look at the distribution of urban tree canopy cover in cities and monitor that change over time. So if we were going to roll out large-scale urban greening programs, we could see how much of our city is covered, what the percentage tree canopy cover is. We can also use those satellites to look at land surface temperatures and see what the heat temperature of the city land surface is. That's a little bit different to ambient temperatures, but we can calculate that through some fancy statistics as well. And increasingly, satellites are enabling us to look at those ambient temperatures. But to close the circle on where I'm going here, if we look at, as Billy was talking about, with people walking and cycling and using public transport, if we were then to use the smart cars with public transport, compare that with our satellite data, look at some of those household data sets around travel behaviours, and then link that to medical data, we can start to see some trends very clearly about health effects in communities that might have received greening and therefore have higher levels of walking and cycling for commuting, not just for recreation, compared to other parts of the city that don't have that.
Mm-hmm. In terms of the medical data, I just want to come back to something you mentioned, Billy, about how you're stressing it has to be collected ethically. What are the challenges around data collection, particularly around health? Are there privacy issues or accessibility issues with that?
Yeah, it's not straightforward, particularly. Ideally, it's nice to be able to link geospatial data to health records, but that's not easy to do. We've done it in Western Australia, where there is the health department. It's got a survey, so it surveys people throughout the state. It gets permission from the study participants to link their data to their hospital records, so that people have to provide their Medicare number and provide approval for that. And it's a significant number of people do. I think it's about 75%, so it's not insignificant. And then also to provide their address so that we can then link the geospatial. Now, what they do is the health department links it all together and then gives it out to the researchers. So it's not done so that what it does is protects the identity. There's lots of checks and balances to protect the identity of the study participants. And I think that's a really critical part of this. I do think there is an issue of the ethics of ethics, because when we start to aggregate data and get data up to a level which to try and protect people's identity, in the end, you get washed out effects. You don't get good results. So it's really important that we maintain these methods of getting the best quality data available, the most fine-grained geospatial, because it's what happens in your neighbourhood that makes a difference to your health, the best possible linkage to health records. But we do this in a way that really manages the data very carefully, and not a cavalier about this, so that the public is confident in the way that we handle data with incredible respect, because I think otherwise that means that we don't get to use that data. And why are we doing this? Why do researchers want to do it? Because we want to answer these important questions about how the built environment affects health, how the interventions that we put in place have an effect on people's health. And then that provides the evidence to say, well, we need to be doing more or less of this. The other thing I think is really critical is, and I think this is one of the things we hadn't done, if you think about mid-century, last century, where we started to plan for the car, we didn't monitor what happened to that. We just went ahead and did it. Now, I think we need to have early warning systems in place to see if what we're doing causes unintended consequences. So it's really important for this to protect ourselves from the future as much as to inform ourselves right now, but we want to try and avoid unintended consequences. So I think it's really important that we do this well and do it ethically, but it is incredibly important to do, and I think we need to get over any hurdles to be able to do that and to bring the community along with us to see that the value of this is that we will be able to build better, healthier, more sustainable cities if we can do this.
If I might jump in, Lauren, one of the unintended consequences that I've been pointing to in my research around urban greening is that sometimes it's a bit of a knee-jerk reaction. Oh my gosh, cities are going to get hotter. Let's get out there and plant a whole lot of trees. But if we don't think about carefully whether we might inadvertently increase volatile organic compounds in the built environment because some tree species emit VOCs, or we might increase pollen counts in the built environment, we might then lead to high levels of asthma and respiratory disease, or even to simple things like overshadowing. So that might not be a big deal on the Gold Coast where it's warm and pleasant all year round, but in Hobart and Launceston where it's cold in winter, and we need to be thinking not just about thermal equity with heat, but also thermal inequalities from having people exposed to extreme cold events. If we don't collect that data, and if we don't think that through carefully, and if we don't think about the right palette of species we're using in our greening, we could cause these unintended consequences. Another example is increasing bushfire hazard. So again, if we're looking at Hobart and Launceston and Adelaide and Canberra, among the most bushfire prone cities in Australia, and we undertake large scale urban greening without thinking about the right palette of species and about planting in the right ways, we might inadvertently heighten bushfire hazard, as Billy had mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm. I imagine that other cities around the world are also obviously facing very similar problems and are implementing strategies to help improve health as well. Billy, are there any particularly good examples of cities elsewhere in the world using planning to improve health? And are there things we can learn from them and what they have done?
Yeah, I was just talking about that this morning about Freiburg, for example, in Germany. This is a regional city, 200,000 people. It's only 155 square kilometres, so it's quite small and compact. But in 1969, they took a decision that they were going to focus on sustainable mobility transport. And for a small city, it's got a tram, 30 kilometres of tram track. There's a service every 7.5 minutes at peak time. You don't need to have a car. They've got 450 kilometres of cycle paths. So when I hear, you know, a small regional city saying, oh, we couldn't have public transport, well, here's an example of a regional city that has got good public transport. They're very committed to creating neighbourhoods with amenity, so complete neighbourhoods with all the amenity that you need for daily living. But the downside is, of course, that they have higher density. So it's a compact city. But it's a high quality of life. It's a very high quality of life that the people have. And they've got some really fantastic demonstration projects where they've been trialing things like sustainable housing and new co-ops to make sure that there are social and affordable housing. The Verbon is the neighbourhood where they've been doing a lot of trialing, and they've got restrictions on thermal comfort, so they make sure that the buildings are built to a very high standard for thermal comfort. And what they've also got in place are a whole range of strategies to have renewable energy. So not only solar, they've got biomass, they've got hydropower, they've got numbers of different sources that they're using, wind power. So they're using alternatives to be able to produce green energy and green renewable energy. So it's a really exciting, to me, that's a really exciting. There's a lot we can learn from that. And I think for regional cities in particular, who often say, oh, we shouldn't do that here, when we've got plenty of space, we can sprawl. It's really disastrous to think that in regional cities that we're going to end up with the same sprawl that we have in our capital cities. It's really embarrassing globally to see how in many ways irresponsible we've been with the resource that we've got and we've just spread out. So I do think that the architects need to step up and come up with different ways of building a housing typology that would meet the needs of the Australian population but achieve better outcomes for the way we're building our cities. And that might be more compact, but double story or whatever, that will actually achieve the sorts of outcomes. But at the moment, what we see in a lot of cities, which is really, really worrying, disturbing actually, is that we are building more compact. So our houses are getting, our blocks are getting smaller, but our houses are getting bigger, as big or bigger. And that means that in terms of urban greening, we've ended up with no green space at all in those houses, and the roofs often touch one another. So from a heat island effect, that's actually disastrous. So I think we really need a bit of creativity, look to other cities, but come up with an Australian way of doing this, because not necessarily what's done in Europe is going to be attractive to us in Australia or to many people in Australia. But I do think we need a bit of courage. I do think we need to have some demonstration projects. We need some courage to try things out differently. My sense, when you see young people protesting around climate change, they don't want business as usual. And they're only a few years off, you know, wanting to get into housing. So I think we need to be looking to a product that meets our needs, so that not just little apartments where families can't live. So properly designing high density housing in a way that meets the needs of families. And trying something different. And I really would encourage people to think outside the square, to come up with different ways of doing things that will produce a better result for us.
Mm-hmm.
I love that you point to Freiburg there, Billy. It's a city that I like to point to oftentimes as well in terms of the initiatives that they're taking. I think, Lauren, one of the key things that we need to understand in Australia is our building codes are horribly outdated. They're 50 years behind where they need to be. We are effectively locking many communities into death traps in the future through some of these building codes. The urban consolidation policies that planners were promoting from the late 1980s onwards were a great idea in terms of reducing block sizes take advantage of the existing infrastructure that's in the built environment without having to build new infrastructure. So it kind of made sense. What we didn't think about was that we were going to have a very powerful development lobby mass-produced housing, these kind of houses you buy from project home style housing, and that we'd end up having some of the biggest house sizes in the world, like Billy has talked about. And we had these perverse and unintended consequences, getting back to that point earlier, where people are plonking the biggest houses in the world on small lots of 400 square meters or smaller. And we've lost green space across cities like Melbourne and Sydney dramatically at such an alarming rate. And it has those flow-on effects, not just from urban heat island effects, but loss of habitat. We're seeing bird species wiped out of Sydney and Melbourne. Magpies are not common in many parts of our cities anymore, and that's heartbreaking. We might see koalas go extinct. There's these cascading effects of unintended consequences from what seemed like good policy ideas at the time. So planners are talking about, to get back to Billy's point, planners are talking about what we call a missing middle when it comes to density. You can have density that's green and it's effective and it provides space for families. It just looks different. At the moment, we have this kind of either or, a house in the suburbs, huge house, 5 bedrooms, 3-car garage is kind of nonsense, or a high rise, 15, 20 story building. Well, there's a plenty of area in the middle there to do density in a smart way. So we could look to Europe a little bit, cities like Barcelona, the Barcelona model, but we can do an Australian version. And we did before in Sydney and Melbourne in terrace housing and in townhouses and in Hobart in the kinds of terrace housing and workers' cottages that existed at the time, which we could basically go with that magic middle of 3 to 7 story development. In China, 7 stories means you don't have to have an elevator. So people walk up those 7 stories, which is really great for physical health, unless you're old or have hip problems, these kinds of things. So, you know, just thinking that through a bit more carefully, we could get some very clever solutions to what are deeply troubling problems at the moment.
I just want to add one other thing, in like the tenement buildings that you see in Scotland and, you know, in Glasgow or Edinburgh. What's great about those is, you know, they might be 3-4 stories high, but at the back they have those little gardens and they're quite significant. And I've seen where they've opened them up so people share a garden. So there's actually quite a lot of space, because a lot of families complain, of course, that one of the problems with apartments and is that they don't, you know, if they've got children, how do they let, they have to supervise their children all the time. So I think it's what I mean about us having to get more creative about the way we do things. We could have and especially in the tenement houses or the terrace housing model, which is a cheaper construction than just all having separate walls, you know, so separate houses. It's a way of us building, getting density, but doing it in a way that suits what's needed in Australia, like having space for children to run around in the back. So I think that we just need a bit of creativity. I mean, Australia's well known for that, and I think we need to apply it in this area.
Mm. I'm interested in how we implement these changes. Like, how can different levels of government shift their policies to support making cities healthier?
I think it's quite challenging, to be very honest. I think governments are trying to do that. I think when you talk to most bureaucrats that work in planning, they know, or the planners, they know that things have to change. Then you've got, you know, you've got a development industry that wants to do things in a certain way, and they push back on reform. But I think what some of the planning departments are doing now, looking creatively at innovation pathways, where there is, you know, what I call the good guys. There are good guy developers, certainly good guy
urban designers who are trying to do things differently, where they've got innovation pathways where they can actually try out demonstration projects to demonstrate it's possible and to come up with different models. I mean, one of the problems, of course, is the financiers of these developments. They do get in the way of doing innovation because they want to have business as usual, because they are sure that business as usual is going to make money. So I think what we need to do is have some of these creative innovation pathways open up to see if we can do things very differently, to showcase and model the different ways, you know, do the role modeling to show that it is possible to do things in a different way. So I think it's possible. I mean, the 20-minute neighbourhood policy that's in Victoria and Melbourne, it's quite a challenging because the devil's in the detail. And what needs to be considered if you want to achieve a 20-minute neighbourhood is levels of density that we don't tend to see so much in new developments anymore. We've estimated that we need to get up to at least, to make a walkable neighbourhood, for example, we need densities of around at least 25 dwellings to 30 dwellings per hectare. That's not very dense. To be honest, it's so low density by a global perspective. But it's very much a different sort of level of density to what we're building in our cities at the moment. Most fringe developments still are around 15 dwellings per hectare. And the trouble with what happens is the way density is measured. Most government departments would measure it as net density rather than gross density. But gross density is actually really critical because gross density tells you how many people are going to be in the area. If you take out the roads and you take out all this, which is important because that's going to determine how viable the shops are and how viable the public transport is, because the numbers of people is actually what determines what's viable. So I think it's really tricky. I think it's possible. I think we just need innovation pathways to actually trial it and to have some really good evaluation that does the demonstration to show that these things can be effective. It's frustrating, to be honest, to think that we have to wait. We've been doing this for a long time now. But what we've been trying to do actually to help with some of this is to try and work out thresholds for the interventions. You know, how much density, how much green space, trying to work this out. And we've got a big study that we've done globally now where we will be hopefully get published next year. But we're trying to work these things out so that these can get into standards. And I know that a lot of people don't like standards because it makes people build to the bottom. But without standards, I just worry that we're going to end up with just business as usual and we'll continue with that. So I just want to try and push the envelope a little bit.
Yeah, that's a really good point there, Billy. And I think, Lauren, that if we look at a city like Hobart, for example, where the average density is about 10 dwelling units per hectare. So remember, Billy said 25 is kind of the magic number. That means we just need to double the density. And you might go, well, hang on a second, Jason, that's a huge ask. How do we double the density? Many dwellings in Hobart have garages underneath them. Increasingly, we're seeing a generation in Australia that are choosing not to have cars, the younger generation. And we're going to see those flow-on effects as we see automation of vehicles, for example, into the future. We will increasingly not need to have garages with these stranded assets, with vehicles sitting around parked for most of the time, either in the garage at home or a parking lot somewhere else, which is really just a waste of money. If we could convert those garages to an additional dwelling unit, and we could, you could double the density in a city fairly quickly. But I think also we tend to rely in Australia on the market to come up with these solutions. And the market, remember, developers build cities, planners don't. So the market has a major role to play, but we've stepped right away from what used to be an important way of providing housing in Australia, which was through social housing. We used to call it public housing in the old days, but through housing cooperatives and through other non-government but non-profit housing providers, we could experiment with these kinds of models that Billy is talking about, because remember, we want to be targeting the most marginalised and disadvantaged people who are disproportionately exposed to many of these health impacts, negative health impacts. We could innovate. We could get that sector to help us do proof of concept and to deliver products that the private sector is unwilling or unable to take that risk, either through banks and financiers or through the development industry, which often has that mantra, well, the market wants this. But really, we create markets. We've been very good at creating markets through advertising for more than 100 years. And we know we can create a market for a new product by, as Billy suggests, proof of concept that this can be done. And usually it's the government who leads that, and then the private sector follows.
I should just say that the Hart Foundation's done a report looking at what people want in their housing. And it's the sort of thing that we're talking about. They want walkable communities with access to shops and services. This is what the people want. And then that coincides with research that we've done as well. We've shown that, you know, 84% of people live in the burbs, but a very significant number of them, more than half of them, would rather live near shops and services. So it, I think there's a latent demand. People often say, oh, it's self-selection when you do these studies that people walk in areas when they walk in walkable areas, it's because they've chosen it. It's true. People who want to live in a walkable area will choose it, but even people who don't necessarily want to live in those areas walk more when they live in those areas. So there's a real health benefit from doing that. And in the burbs, in the outer suburban areas, there's lots of people who would really like to live there, but they can't afford it. So to me, there's a latent demand for this product. To me, it is unethical and unjust that we provide people with housing without having all the amenity that people need to live. And I just look at children who live in areas where there isn't amenity, where they have to rely on their parents to get them to go to a shop or go to the library because it's too far away. That doesn't seem like a just way of building a city to me. It's an issue of how we ethically build our cities and the levels of justice that we're prepared to, well, I think that we should sign up for. I've always thought that people who build cities should sign like a Hippocratic Oath, and the underlying premise of the Hippocratic Oath is first do no harm. And I think, you know, we are harming humans, but we're also harming ecosystems and the environment by building the cities that way we are. And I think that's a really big responsibility that we all have to take in trying to do things in a different way.
Mm-hmm. Lauren, if I can maybe just add quickly one additional thing there. Billy rightly pointed to the loss of ecosystems across our urban environments. Many people don't think our cities are places where we have non-human species, but we do. They're rich in a range of different species. One of the consequences of isolating populations in unhealthy, in insalubrious environments is you don't just harm an existing generation, but it can have intergenerational effects that ripple across generations. So we saw this in cities in the United States, for example, and in South Africa, where different models of apartheid entrenched poverty and kept people of color confined in segregated neighborhoods. We had that in Australia too. The effects were not just that a generation who was exposed to that got exposed to toxins or poor air quality or had poor jobs or bad schooling, but that their children, as Billy said, don't have choices. They can't easily get to jobs. They can't easily get to education or schooling. Older people can't easily get to hospitals and healthcare. And so those children don't get the kind of level of education that others might get. The inequality then gets entrenched and it ripples across a generation. But more importantly, we're learning through contemporary advances in science about the human microbiome. And so exposure to green space affects us in ways, where we now know that the gut plays a major role in our health and regulating all kinds of bodily processes. It's directly linked to the brain. So in areas that are less green, people may in fact have children who have these kinds of poor health outcomes. And then through epigenetics, it may be that we transfer genes to future generations that are further entrenching this disadvantage. So I guess injustice is pernicious and it ripples across human populations in ways that we're only just beginning to come to terms with.
Yeah, that is fascinating and concerning, isn't it, to realize how it's all interlinked. You've both spoken a lot about all the different changes that you've seen other cities make and changes that potentially Australian cities can make. But I'm wondering if you have a vision for what you'd like to see changed in the next 10 years in Australia. Like, what will our cities look like or should look like in 2030? I'd love to hear both of your thoughts on that. Maybe, Billy, you can start.
Well, what I'd really like to see is leadership. That's the most important thing, because the only way those cities have changed is really serious leadership, really taking climate change, creating sustainable city and sustainable development seriously. And unless we have that, we are never going to change. It takes a long time to build a city. By 2030, we won't see a massive change. We can do things like we can put in the cycling infrastructure, we could put in the tree canopy, we could start to put in tree canopy, although, you know, it takes a long time for a tree to grow as well. But nevertheless, cycling infrastructure is something that we could do immediately. And we have done maps where you show, or if you put cycling infrastructure all around all the train stations, all the activity centres, 5 kilometres, that would be a really great thing for Infrastructure Australia to invest in, because it would provide a safe cycling environment for people to be able to use sustainable mobility. But in terms of the way we build our cities, in 10 years' time, we'll only be starting to see, if we did it right from today, in 10 years' time, we'll only be seeing, you know, the beginnings of the change that we need to see. So it's not easy to see massive change by 2030, but I think what I'd really like to see right now is a change in our attitudes, change in our leadership, a change in our attitude to way our seriousness about doing things differently. And people who are, you know, I've got the both in the community to help bring the community along with us, because we need a transformation and we need all hands on deck to have the discussions at barbecues, to be at the, you know, the school, and to be discussing these sorts of issues with other parents. We need every at workplaces, we need everyone to be discussing how we can build our cities in a way that it's not business as usual. It's really taking this seriously, that we have a climate crisis, we have a health crisis, but the climate crisis is a major impact on health. It will be devastating for health, and we just need to do things differently. But that's going to require leadership across the board, and we need to enable those people with discussion points, and we need to at the same time be investing in the things that we can do easily, plus the long-term thing. So I think it needs, when you think about the way we build cities, it's not one intervention that's going to do it. It's a combination. We've captured it in the 11 Ds, we're calling it. So we've got the 11 Ds now. It used to be the 8 Ds. Now we've got 11, which we're going to be publishing next year. So it's a combination of integrated interventions that need to go on to actually build the cities that we need. So I think that would be what I would like to see. In the next 2 years, I'd like to see, you know, serious leadership. We've got elections coming up federally, and most states will have elections. We need to have some serious leadership that creates the authorising environments for the integrated planning that's required to build the cities that we need. Because in our cities, we need all the government departments working together. It needs to be integrated, because there's no point education having one approach to the way where it puts its schools and how it builds the, where it locates its schools on busy roads. No, we want them located in the middle of suburbs where there's low traffic, so children can walk to school, so parents don't need to drive their school. You know what I mean? It's a system. So we need everyone working towards the same objective of building more sustainable cities. Mm-hmm.
So I'd support everything that Billy said, of course. I think that that she's raised some amazing points there, that especially that this change takes time, and 10 years from now isn't much. Developers, when they're planning for large scale subdivisions, are planning 30 years out, 35 years out for master plan communities. When we think about the kinds of changes that are coming our way, though, we don't have that luxury. So if you look at the fact that around 30% of the world's population is currently exposed to life-threatening temperatures and extreme heat, and that's about 12,000 deaths annually attributed to that, with climate change impacts ramping up, we're going to see more pronounced effects happening much faster as well. And closing the circle back to some of Billy's points about vector-borne disease, as the tropics expand polewards, we're going to see new diseases showing up in Australian cities as well. So what I would like to see, I guess, in a nutshell, is a Jedi approach taken to planning, which is justice, equity, diversity, and inclusion. We should be putting justice at the front and centre of our planning approaches. It's easy to get despondent and to be even a bit paralysed about the kind of change that's coming our way. But I'm often heartened by seeing leadership in places we don't necessarily expect to see it. So yes, we look to our elected leaders and often they fail and let us down in very profound ways. and continue to do so. And that's really easy to get despairing about that. But there's other kinds of leadership as well. The Planning Institute of Australia has just launched its first national advocacy campaign in the history of the Institute. Planners typically have sat on fences and gone, oh, we're not going to get involved in the politics. But with climate change, planners have rolled up their sleeves and gone, this is too big an issue to sit back and let this happen. And they're taking climate change head on. And so around Australia in each state, there are 10 asks that have been mounted by the Planning Institute in those states around climate change. And they go directly to the kinds of things Billy's been talking about and I've been talking about, changing building codes, for example, changing levels of urban greening, improving public transport, designing in ways that build health into cities. So I think what I would like to see is that ripple effect of leadership and people realizing they can be leaders themselves, even in their own government department, in their own local government office, and start to champion some of these initiatives. But if you're going to ask me for two things, it would have to be greening and public transport, other things I would love to see increase dramatically across our cities in the next 10 years.
Mm-hmm. And obviously people watching this, the average person watching this, cares about their health and they care about where they live. What would you say, just to an average person, what can they do if they care about these things?
I think what people could do is, often when we're buying or we're renting a place, we don't look at the built environment around where it's located. And I think what will change the development industry is if people start to demand it. And so what people can do is actually look very carefully where they're living and where they want to live. They could be involved in writing a letter to their Member of Parliament, or writing a letter to their planning department and say, that they want to live in these sorts of environments. I'd really love to see a letter campaign going on, saying that this is what we want. We don't want business as usual. We want something different, and mobilising their friends and their family to do the same thing. But I think choosing, being selective, and I know sometimes it's interesting actually when people choose where to live, they probably often will buy somewhere where they can afford. They don't think about, again, these unintended consequences. So you buy a house out in the fringe of a city, you've got a couple of kids. You don't realise that if there's no public transport or infrequent public transport, if there's nowhere to walk or cycle to, you'll spend a lot of time in the car. A lot of time out of the community, and a lot of time not with your family, and a lot of expenses. So when doing the budget about where to live, what one people could start to do is to think, well, what if I didn't need to have two cars? And what if I could ride one of us could ride our bike to the train station or the public transport hub? Could that save us a car? And that saves a lot of money in a year. So I think maybe people need to think a little bit more selectively. Maybe people do, but a lot of people probably don't. And it's only when they get out to these fringe developments that they realise that they have a bigger house, but then they're spending a lot of time at home. So I think things like that are really important. But I do think the conversations, this is a change that we have to make. It's really serious, and it's important that they have conversations and have the debates with their friends and family, their work colleagues, at the school, wherever. It needs to be, they need to be listening to their children, because I can bet your bottom dollar that their children are worried about this, and they're going to ask them in the future, what were you thinking? I think we all feel very responsible for thinking about the children's future.
Yeah.
So you're right, Billy. I have colleagues who look at climate anxiety as a very real issue, and there are generations now who are deeply, deeply worried and incredibly angry that we're not taking action and that the generations before them have put them into a big mess. But luckily, there are some things we can do. So my colleagues and I have a website called Climate Adaptation Australia, and we've been collecting stories from around Australia, from the different states, in what we call quiet activism. And it's the small actions that the everyday person can take, whether that's looking to take public transport one or two days a week, or planting a tree, or getting together with neighbours to begin to talk about how you can put a small roster in place to check on the elderly folk in your immediate neighbourhood who might be exposed to extreme heat, locked inside their house, not able to get out because they're not very mobile. And you can just knock on their door and check on them. Are you okay? Do you need us to get anything? So there's things building on that Australian tradition of mateship and egalitarianism and looking after each other, which I think most Australians would value. And to look at some of these small everyday practices that we can put in place that will produce profound differences. One of the worst things that we can do is to lead cities to create cities that result in people being socially isolated and vulnerable and lonely and not having contact with others. So the more that we can do through these everyday practices to connect with others, to build coalitions of support, to apply pressure to politicians and other decision makers, but to know we can take these individual actions as well. For example, the tree planting, putting on a lighter coloured roof next time you have to do a roof repair or a roof replacement, or even just carpooling, to get back to Billy's point about people who are isolated in the outer suburbs and might not have access to good public transport. Putting those little things in place can make a big difference. Mm-hmm.
Dusting off the bike and getting your bike out and going starting to cycle.
Community really bike rides.
Really good for your health, and it's really good for the environment. So, and it sometimes it just takes, and actually asking your neighbour, I'm going to cycle down here, would you like to cycle too? So that, you know, people start to cycle in, you know, the comfort of crowds. So, I think there's lots of things that people can do individually and collectively.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Billy. And thank you, Jason, too. Thank you both for such an amazing discussion today and such an important discussion as well. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, it has. It's been terrific. Thank you.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to this episode. Remember that you can head to cosmosmagazine.com via the link in the description for more great content. You can also subscribe to Cosmos Magazine, Australia's only science print magazine, and Cosmos Weekly, with its unique approach to how science, current affairs, and the economy intersect. You can watch and listen to all our Cosmos briefings via the link that you'll also find in the description. And remember, if you support science and its communication, please support our work at the Royal Institution of Australia. I'm Chuck Smeaton. Today's interview was hosted by Lauren Fuge, and our executive producer is Catherine Roberts. Thank you.